Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, Helen Fospero. Today's guest is the wonderfully funny and eloquent broadcaster, the Reverend Richard Coles, vicar of Findon in Northamptonshire, host of Radio 4's Saturday Live, former communard, musician, Twitter aficionado, and much, much more. Sadly, Richard's world was shattered, though, in December, when he unexpectedly lost his partner of 12 years, the Reverend David Coles, at the age of 42, to an underlying health condition. And before we hear some of Richard's other wonderful stories, it really feels right. I hope Richard agrees with me to start off with David. Richard, so lovely to have you join me today. Thank you.
Lovely to be here. And also, I discovered I've been mispronouncing your surname as long as I have known you.
Have you? Have you been saying Fospero?
Everyone says Fospero to rhyme with Prospero, and I hear it's Fospero.
Well, I think technically you're actually correct, and I'm incorrect, because the name comes from Calabria, and so I'm sure in Italy they probably say Fospero, and it's a typo.
Oh, well. I should just do what I'm told.
It's a typo from Ellis Island, I think. It probably should be Prospero. So you're right and I'm wrong. But you've been in the nation's and my thoughts over the last few months. How are you doing, Richard?
I think I'm standing up and I'm facing forward, and that's about as good as it gets at the moment. But it's important because grief has a sort of strange, it's like a sort of extra gravity, and it kind of pulls at you sometimes, and you have to make more of an effort to resist that downward pull, I think. And I mean... Everyone is full of ideas about how you do grief, and there are kind of lots of schools of thought about that, and people are helpful or want to be helpful. But actually what happens is just what happens, and you have very little agency in it, I've found. It's something that happens to you rather than something that you do. And even though I suppose I have expertise in it because it's part of my, you know, my daily work, when it is actually happening to you, that doesn't really make much of a difference. So you have to find ways of kind of facing forward, I think, and standing up. Sounds like water skiing, doesn't it? And 6 months, 7 months in, that's sort of beginning to happen. But I get these sort of bad days sometimes. So you get kind of 3-day trough in which it's kind of difficult again. But that's how it is. And also, I don't really want it to be easy because I feel I lost the love of my life, and that's not going to be easy. Nor should it be. So that's where I am at the moment, I think.
My canon friend lost his wife recently, and it's interesting what you were saying there about, you know, you're a man of the cloth. And I think people make this assumption that there's some kind of protective cloak which makes you more immune to grief because you deal with it. It's sort of death's part of the job in a way. And the personal grief, he found it incredibly hard to cope with, and he said it had really taken him by surprise. But what keeps you standing forward?
That's a good question. I mean, partly necessity. You have to do things, right? So the kind of awful burden of things like sadmin, as I call it, the kind of bureaucracy of death, getting your way through that is strangely helpful, actually, although there are kind of moments when you think, if I have to deal with a failing computer algorithm that's still sending mail to David, even though it's been dead for 7 months, that's a kind of annoying. But actually just having to deal with it does give you kind of footholds on that sheer cliff that you're climbing. That's quite good. The best thing, of course, actually, is the love and care of other people. And sometimes when I haven't really been able to manage it, I've utterly relied on that. And that's been really good. Lockdown has been really quite helpful for me. And I think it's because my tendency has always been to throw myself into work, particularly when things are tough. And that's always been a sort of way I think of, I've thought in the past, a way of dealing with things. I think now it's probably a way of not dealing with things. And because of lockdown, I was just stuck in the house with the dogs, stuck in the parish, not able to see anybody, not able to do very much. So I just had to let all that stuff happen. And I'm glad I did now because it needed to. And it was interesting because it happened in the spring. David was a fantastic gardener. And in that lovely patch in April and May, I was out in the garden every day, watching the garden pay tribute to him as things came that he had planted. And that was lovely and also rather healing, I think. Somebody said to me the other day, have you got over it? And it was kindly meant, but it's not something you get over. You know, it's not like the flu. It's more like losing a leg. you adapt. So you just have to find a way of walking again, I think, which is, you know, what's happening.
And he was, as you said, the love of your life. What made David the one for you?
I have no idea, because on paper it should have not got off the starting blocks, actually. We were very different. He's 15 years younger than me. And he liked things that I don't like, and I liked things that he didn't like. So we would have constant, complex negotiations about television, because I was only allowed Match of the Day if he could have Two Ugly Betties. Anyway, we worked it out. But of course, it's great to have someone who's not like you. I've spent a lot of my life sort of pleasing myself, really, and living the life I wanted to lead at the speed I wanted to live it, and with a sort of degree of freedom that all of a sudden I couldn't, because there was somebody else who was of equal importance. And David patiently put up with me taking a while to adapt to that. But that was the best thing, really, was kind of learning what it means to love someone. And I've always got that, and nothing of that is diminished. And for that, you know, I'd be always grateful.
You were quoted in a piece you did for The Guardian recently as saying that he knew you needed to have the fires of your rampant ego stoked and was supportive of that. That quote really made me smile.
He was really good at that. I mean, he knew that there were certain things that I needed in order to be happy. And one of them was to find the spotlight in which I could stand. The tough thing about that for David, and credit to him for putting up with it, was that if I was in the spotlight, it necessarily meant that he was in the dark. And actually, most of the time, he was quite happy with that. But there were times when the brisk movement with which I would occupy centre stage did rather leave him behind. And that would sometimes be frustrating. But of course, no one is a star in their own vicarage, if you see what I mean. And the sort of self-aggrandizing, self-serving, ego-boosting elements of that, he was pretty ruthless in dispatching them. And I could take it from him in ways that I maybe couldn't from other people. And that was very good.
And have your lovely Dachshunds, Pongo and Daisy, been a great comfort to you?
Yeah. I mean, funnily enough, another one of the best things about lockdown has been, I know this sounds like a mad thing to say, it's really deepened and enriched my relationship with the dogs, because we've spent all day, every day together. And dogs and humans are kind of made for each other, actually. We've both greatly benefited from that. And also, they're on their last legs. They're both over 10, and that's sort of approaching the end of their lives. And I'm just really, really glad that we had this 6 months to be together and exclusively together. It's been really good.
Oh, I think a widow as well gave you some words of wisdom, and her husband's accordion, didn't she?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's been one of the discoveries of lockdown. I had a parishioner who died and left me his accordion. And so I started learning the accordion. In fact, I'd started just before lockdown. And then I've had a wonderful teacher called Yanis, and he started me on lessons. And then we went on to Zoom lessons. And actually, there's nothing, as a kind of thing to do in grief, the job is actually quite detailed and defined. I have to learn about buttons. I have to learn about bellows techniques. I've got lots of technical stuff to master. And I can do that without having to think about existential matters, if you see what I mean. But what you produce is music. And nothing, I think, articulates existential matters better than music. So that's been an interesting process. And I've found that that concentration on detail has produced something at the end of it, which I think has given voice to parts of me that need to be given voice.
You're prolific on Twitter. I mean, I'm addicted to your Twitter feed. I love the fact that you share your life on there. And so I was fascinated today to discover that you join us on the tercentenary of the birth of the fourth Earl Ferrers, the last peer to be hanged.
Yeah, well, the last peer to be hanged in Britain.
That's a good story.
He shot his steward. He was a debauched libertine and also an alcoholic, and I think probably not in the best of mental health. And because of that, trustees took over the management of his estates, and the steward who was responsible for that had the very difficult job of standing between the Earl and his trustees. It was in 1760, I think. Anyway, the Earl shot him and killed him and faced trial with his peers in Westminster Hall. I think everyone thought he'd get away with it being a peer. But he wasn't. He was convicted and hanged at Tyburn on a special gallows, all done out with black velvet. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, when Twitter happened, I was just not interested at all. But I had to, because of working with the BBC. They said, you must maintain a presence on social media. And I thought, 140 characters. What a bizarrely kind of limited palette that is to paint with. But then I actually started really doing, and it's one of those ideas which is simple but powerful, and you don't really see it at first. But what it basically does is it licenses innumerable brief encounters, and if you get the hang of it, that can be extremely rewarding and delightful and sometimes challenging. And I took to it like a duck to water, actually, and I've just sort of carried on doing it, worked out better ways of doing it as we've gone along, as everybody else has. And although Twitter can be a sort of maelstrom of irrationality and prejudice and anger, there are lots of people who are finding ways of doing it in ways that are kind of seemly and well-mannered and aim to sort of increase the delight and pleasure of life. So that's what I try to do.
I think as well, with your Radio 4 programme, it really brings listeners closer to you. And because they can reply, I messaged you this morning and immediately you replied publicly on Twitter, people feel that you're a real person, and that they know you and that they know what's going on in your world. And there's something quite nice about that, isn't there, friendship-wise, I think.
It's very interesting, that, isn't it? Because in a way, I mean, Twitter is about connecting people. And although as Twitter becomes busier and people who do it become more professionalised, what happens, of course, is that people work out ways of distancing themselves and maintaining privacy. I like the directness of it, actually. I mean, I have too many tweets come in to see all the time, so I fail in responding sometimes simply because I don't see stuff. But if I do see stuff, you know, it doesn't matter who it's from, I will reply. And then there's a sort of triage that after a while you get to see people who really... I mean, lots of good friendships I've made in real life in the past 10 or so years began on Twitter. And that's because...
Did they?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I do now is if ever I go away, quite often I will just tweet ahead and say, I am going to be in Bury St Edmunds on Tuesday. Is anyone around? And lots of people will say, oh, yeah, come for tea or come for lunch or something, or I'll meet you there or I'll show you this. And now I do that all the time and it's been great.
You were in Walbeswick, weren't you? And I like the way you described that as, what was it, Boudin with dressed crabs?
That's right. Well, I love the... I mean, Boudin is one of my favourite painters, actually. He did these wonderful plein air paintings of, I think, the Normandy coast or the Brittany coast. And there's something about the East Coast that reminds me of that. And it's all these middle-class people letting their hair down on a beach, and it's holiday time, and everyone's a sort of bit sort of excited. And you've got that watery light that you associate with beaches of these latitudes. And also, it is dressed crabs, as anyone who has spent any time on that coast will know. You're never very far from a dressed crab, a delicacy of which I am particularly fond.
I'm just sticking with Twitter before we move on. What's happened with your bike? Did you get your bike back in the end?
No, I didn't. So the British Transport Police have very kindly and helpfully are looking for my bicycle, which was stolen from Wellingborough Station. There was a moment's hopes were lifted when they discovered a gentleman in Bedford who had more than 100 bikes in his yard. And there are continuing inquiries as to the provenance of those bikes, but nothing which has to date revealed my own. So it's insured and everything, so it's taken care of. But I really missed the bike. I loved the bike.
Oh, it just feels so wrong, doesn't it, when somebody takes something like that? I've got an old black sort of knackered old bike and I absolutely love it. I'd be heartbroken if anybody took it. So take us back, Richard, if you would, to your childhood. You were born in Kettering, which isn't far, I don't think, from your current parish. Were they happy days?
Actually, I was actually born in Northampton, which is the county town, but grew up on the edge of Kettering. They were happy days until through adolescence, which got a bit rocky for me. I mean, Kettering is the sort of place that is kind of the butt of a joke. Monty Python used to sort of make jokes about Kettering and people from Kettering. And it is the archetypal dowdy Midland town. And it's the sort of place where when I was a teenager, I thought I've got to escape from here because nothing that I want to do, I'm going to do in Kettering. And yet now I'm back living very near it. And I realise with more clarity with every passing year that I am Kettering, that Kettering made me. And actually I have a lot to be thankful to Kettering for. It's never going to win a prize as Britain's loveliest town. Charles Dickens was rude about it in the middle 19th century. But it's my town, and it is a town, when I was growing up, of Midland manufacturers making boots and shoes, and that was my family background. And in spite of a life which would seem to have very little to do with that, I realised that there is a Midland manufacturer inside me, and I have lots to be grateful for on that count.
I was born in Grimsby, and Grimsby, I could say similar things about Grimsby to Kettering. You know, Sacha Baron Cohen made a whole film about Grimsby, but, you know, you can take the girl out of Grimsby. I mean, it is who I am, and I left when I was 17. So, you know, much like you, you grow up there and you think you're going to escape and do other things, but there's a part of you that's, it's in your roots, isn't it, when you come from...
And I think also there's something else which I know now because I've been a vicar here now for 10 years. And before, I was in central London before that, and then in Lincolnshire before that. And one of the great privileges you get in this job is that you learn, it's such an obvious truism, but I think lots of us forget it, that complex, interesting, thoughtful people living complex, interesting, thoughtful lives happen everywhere. And I think it's just a sort of really sad state of our times, this kind of persistent belief that the only things of note or interest happen within the M25 or in the Northern Powerhouse, because it's simply not true. And there is this kind of awful kind of ignorance of the richness of lives being lived in places like Kettering on the part of people who don't bother to get to know them.
You posted a fabulous picture of you and your family on holiday in Norfolk in the 70s. And that really reminded me of my growing up, actually, because, I mean, staycations, they're big at the moment, obviously, but they were all the rage. Provided me with some of my happiest, earliest memories, you know, sand in the egg botties on the beach and sitting on the beach with my grandfather, and he was wearing full-on tweed on a hot day on Cleethorpes Beach. I mean, they looked fun times from that photo that you put out.
Well, they were. It's interesting. I was thinking about it yesterday when I was in Walberswick. My parents had a cottage in a village called Ringstead in North Norfolk, which is not very far from Hunstanton. And so we had a beach hut at Hunstanton as well. So our whole hot summer, we would just, when we were kids, we would just decamp to the cottage, and my father would come for weekends and we'd be working during the week. And then he would take 3 weeks off. And we had these idyllic holidays when we'd spend all day on the beach. We'd go shrimping and then we'd cook shrimps on a primus stove in the beach hut. And then we'd go home. It was just wonderful now. And of course, at the time, all I did was complain that we weren't going to Mallorca like my friends from school. Now I wish we still had it, although North Norfolk now is a sort of playground for millionaires in a way that it wasn't.
Wow, it's like Chelsea on Sea now, isn't it, North Norfolk?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it tells you something about Britain now, but there are lots of people who are making lots of money in London and who are buying property in those ports, because I think partly it's nostalgia for, you know, a kind of simpler sort of life, and partly also because they can afford it. And it's interesting, yeah. You know, a little cottage around there now, it's not unusual to find one that's, you know, £600,000, which is astonishing, but
that's
that just
amazing,
tells you something about the way money and property works now.
Absolutely. Now, was music a big part of your growing up? I know you were a choir boy, weren't you?
Yeah, from very early on, I loved music. And my mother tells me that when I was a baby, I used to react very strongly to music on the radio. Either I would cry if it was sad and I would gurgle if it was happy. So very early on, that was happening. My father loved music. He loved the sort of great 19th century German Austrian repertoire. So he loved Beethoven and Mahler and Bruckner. My grandfather was a pianist, but I realised now he mostly played smutty songs on the piano to make people laugh. My mother's aunt, my great aunt, she was a violinist and played in a London orchestra. So it was always around. And then at the age of four, I took to the piano and really enjoyed it and found it easy. And then I took up the violin as well. And then I was a chorister at eight. So music making, and in the choir, music making to a, you know, high standard was very early experience for me. And the great thing about starting young, I think, in music is you don't know it's a chore. So learning the piano at four, I kind of made quite a lot of progress in technique without realising that practising was boring, because everything was fun when I was four, if you see what I mean.
No, absolutely.
So that was good. And it's been with me ever since. And I mean, my musical CV has been sort of complex and kind of ranges quite wide and far. But it's been a constant, and I'm going through really, I think one of the things that, again, in lockdown that I've really loved is that I've been listening with more concentration and more seriously to music in lockdown, and I've really enjoyed that.
What sort of music have you been listening to? Are you more of a classical, or you still like the old pop stuff?
I'm fairly sort of broad in my tastes, though. I mean, I find I've always listened to more classical music than anything else. That's where I began, and I've just known it well, I think. Because I've been playing the piano a lot more in lockdown as well, I've been listening to a lot of pianists and rediscovering pianists that I've loved, but discovering pianists that I hadn't really listened to before. Emil Gilels, great Russian pianist of the 20th century, who died in the 1980s. And I was aware of him, of course, he's a great, great pianist. But I've become absolutely bewitched by his playing, and I'm listening to him a lot.
Oh, I'll have a little listen to that. I mean, we will come on to your more famous musical aspect of your career shortly. I danced around my handbag at Pier 39 at Gleethorpes many a time to don't leave me this way. But
glad to hear it.
More on that in a moment. But just going back to being a chorister, you weren't particularly religious at that point, were you? In fact, I think I read, didn't you set up an atheist society at school at one point?
Yeah, I started the Willingham School Chapel Choir Atheists Club because... I was absolutely certain from the age of eight, I think, my grandfather, the piano playing grandfather, who was a character, he would give us whiskey and cigarettes when we were kids and stuff. And he was just larger than life. He used to have plus fours and a waxed moustache. I mean, I realise now he was sort of Mr. Toad, although I didn't realise at the time. But he died when I was eight. And that was the first time anyone I'd ever known had died. And I can remember then thinking what religious people say is nonsense. And I was just certain, without even having to really think about it, that the claims of religion were false and they were fairy tale, and that no one in his right mind or her right mind could possibly want to live like that. So I didn't believe any of it at all. But it was complicated because I really liked the things that religion did. I loved the music. I liked the people. I liked being in chapel an awful lot, not just because, you know, often the buildings are attractive, but actually there's something about the distinctiveness of what went on in them that I responded to. And I just sort of experienced that without question. It certainly didn't infiltrate into my conscious thoughts about why that might be the case until I was older.
That's interesting. I think, you know, when you talk about the old buildings there, I think that sense of history is wonderful. And I think whether you're religious or not, the sense of community is really lovely that people can appreciate from church.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things we've been experiencing in lockdown, of course, is that for the first time since, I think, ever, maybe the Black Death, we've been locked out of church. And we've been obviously carrying on church through other means, through contact, through social media, through the internet, all the different ways that, you know. But actually what we really want to be is gathered back in the building, doing what we do. We've been back in church now for a few weeks, but I remember when we opened up on the first Sunday after months of being closed, I really was worried that nobody would come, that they would have discovered in lockdown what she really wanted to do was to listen to Kate Botley on Radio 2, or I don't know, just sleep in. But actually, people did come back, and it's been very powerful in church, even though we can't do lots of things we want to do. We can't sing at the moment. We can't have a choir. We're socially distant from each other. But it's been really important to be back.
So what was the moment, you know, from 8-year-old little boy sort of being quite determined that it was all a load of old nonsense? When was the turning point when you discovered religion and realised that actually you wanted to study theology?
Well, there was a crash and burn when I came out of pop music. So like lots of people in pop bands, I had a sort of lost year, took lots of drugs, got into loads of trouble. I had a lovely time, actually, but it ended messily. And it was trying to sort of pick myself up and dust myself down that I started, what I started feeling was I wanted to connect to what I had felt when I was a boy in chapel. And that was that this was a place that was distinctive and that there was peace there and also challenge there, and that all of a sudden began to appeal. And I honestly thought at first it was a sign of insanity. So I went to see a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, "You don't need to see me, you need to see a priest." And eventually I did, and I went along to this church. And the minute I stepped in and it started going, I realized that it was where I wanted to be. And I've been there ever since.
And do you feel that you really are where you want to be for good now? That must be a nice feeling.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's sort of the air you breathe and walking down the street sort of thing, in the sense that it's my everyday, every minute experience. But there are moments, and interesting, again, lockdown has been one of them, where I get a flash of realisation of just quite how wonderful it is. And when I say that, I don't mean it's like going to Disney World and all your dreams coming true. It's not that. And I don't even mean that it's consoling, although it can be that. Much more, it's about the challenge. It's about how do we live with integrity and honestly alongside other people. And it's a sort of long experiment in that. And it's absolutely fascinating. And
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And wonderful things happen and terrible things happen. And everything comes to your door. And the really searching question is, of course, the light it shines on you, particularly into the places of you that are obscure or in shadow or that you wish to conceal. And then you have the task of learning to live in that light. And that's where it's all interesting.
You touched on your pop star career in the 80s.
I know.
You played sax in Bronski Beat, just for any listener who doesn't know this. And then you formed the Communards with Jimmy Somerville. How did you two meet and get together?
Well, Jimmy and I were both gay runaways. We were both 18. Actually, Jimmy was 19. And we ran away, me from Kettering and Jimmy from very different background, really tough working class background in Glasgow. Because that's what you did in those days. It was 1980. We were teenagers. We both knew that the life we wanted to lead was not going to be lived where we were. So it was a very hostile world for gay people in those days. And so we ran away to London and found our way into a city which then was permeable to the young and the poor in a way it's not now, I don't think, or much harder. We found a foothold and we weren't the only people who did it. So there's a group of us, we were all in our late teens. We wanted to live this new life and we realised that together we could have a better chance of doing that. So we did. And out of that, all sorts of things happened. Bronski Beat happened. Because nightclubs was a big, you know, that was the sort of places in which our lives happened. And so music and dancing was really important. And so bands happened. And one of the bands was Bronski Beat. I went in to play saxophone with that. And then Jimmy and I left and we started our own band. And I was just very fortunate that I managed to hitch my wagon to someone of a really rare and spectacular talent. And I was very lucky because that was what kind of hauled me into being a highly unlikely pop star.
We mentioned me dancing around my handbag to Don't Leave Me This Way. I mean, not only did that for the Communards get you to number one, it was 1986's best-selling single, wasn't it? I mean, that's quite some achievement.
Yes. I mean, a measured achievement in the sense that it was a cover version, of course, which tells you something. All our biggest hits were cover versions, which tells you something about our merits as songwriters. But it was a record that I think captured the moment. And for lots of people, it was the record of that summer. I was at Do the other day and somebody played it there. And it's still, it sounds boasty, but it did actually fill a dance floor as it did back then. It's just one of those records that people like to dance to.
And were they heady times, Richard?
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. I mean, it was incredibly exciting. It was incredibly rewarding. You know, we did all the things. It was like winning a lottery in some way. So we were lucky. We were very fortunate. We were immensely well rewarded for what we did. Everyone was pleased to see us. We were famous and we were vindicated because we were always very open about being gay and about pushing back on those kind of boundaries of inclusion and exclusion. And that was really good. But it was also tough because Jimmy and I, our relationship was not always easy, very common with the musician one and the singer one. And also, like lots of gay men of our age and background, we were very damaged by our experiences growing up, and that damage played out and needed dealing with. So that was tricky. Then, of course, in the middle of it, HIV arrived and that changed everything. So at the very height of our success, all of a sudden, half the people we knew died horribly. And we had to start dealing with that reality. And that was really tough.
I know you lost a lot of friends to HIV. Did the epidemic bring you closer to God, do you think, and religion?
Yeah, I think it did. I think anyone who is obliged to confront the reality of mortality is more likely to start asking the sorts of questions that religion offer answers to. See what I mean? So if you look at huge spikes of interest and commitment to the Church of England after the First World War and after the Second World War, and I think that for gay men of my generation, the AIDS crisis was our world war, if you see what I mean. And for me, religion began to provide just reliable and resilient and attractive and compelling answers to the questions that I was asking. Lots of people, of course, have found absolutely no need to go to religion for that at all, and good luck to them. But quite a few of us did. And now, as I approach 60, I sometimes meet up with friends of mine who went through the same experience. And lots of us have found our way to religion of one kind or another, or to some sort of transcendent reality that places you confidently in a narrative that was there before you were and will be there after you've gone. And that's important.
You've always been very open about your sexuality, and I'm sure there were probably some difficult times growing up in Kettering. But I do love the story about how you came out to Mum, and that involved music, didn't it?
Thank goodness for pop music, because that I was 16. Also, I knew I was gay from the get go, really. And I really didn't like the necessary concealment of the time, because I didn't want to live a lie, to coin a phrase. It was very painful sometimes, and I just wasn't prepared to put up with that. So I thought, well, it's going to be done with. So I played my mother Tom Robinson's Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay. It must have been 5 times, where eventually she said, "Darling, are you trying to tell me something?" and then we had the conversation.
And were your family supportive?
Yeah, they always. I mean, I never doubted for a second that they loved me. And the older I get, the more I realise how fortunate that I had that and have that. It wasn't what they wanted to hear. And of course, my parents being of their age and generation, they didn't really have a lot of positive images associated with homosexuality. So it was a bit of a voyage of discovery for them. But I never, ever doubted their love, and they never failed in providing it. And that was really good.
I love reading about Mum on Twitter, and this conversation made me laugh the other day. "You, how was your day? Mum, not great. You, oh dear, why? Mum, I can't remember, but it was horrid. I'm watching an interesting programme on Greece, by the way, so if there's nothing else..." You have a lovely relationship, don't you?
Yeah, she's great. I've always been close to Mum. She said to me the other day that she feels that we're as much friends now as mother and son, and she'll tell me anything, and I can tell her anything. And she's very, very funny, and she's very unsentimental. And as she's got old, I mean, she was never someone who was, I think, particularly inhibited about speaking her mind. But as she's got older, she's got even less inhibited about it. She has dementia, I should say. So her mental powers are sometimes a bit feeble, and she gets a bit forgetful, and sometimes she's not sure who people are or who she is. But her shrewd view of the world and her funny way of expressing herself, that's not diminished.
And has she enjoyed your TV stuff, you know, Strictly, Celebrity MasterChef? Have I got news for you?
I know that she does enjoy it, but she's been one of my more trenchant critics. And when I was on Strictly, when I did my Paso Doble, I said, "What did you make of it?" And she said, "Honestly?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "You look like a walrus that had been tasered."
You can always rely on Mum to give you the truth, eh?
Yeah, it just makes me laugh, actually. Sometimes people are a bit taken aback at quite how direct she can be. But it just always makes me laugh. And she's shrewd, and she knows me really well, and she will not let me get away with nonsense, as I would sometimes wish to.
Did you enjoy the dancing experience and the cooking experience as well? Because they're both full-on shows to do, aren't they?
Well, I have to say, I loved the cooking experience, partly because I was better at it, and I really, really enjoyed it, and I love cooking. And one of the great things about MasterChef is that you get to spend time standing next to people who really know what they're doing. And for me, that's always been my preferred teaching model, if I can put it that way. So being in the professional kitchen, standing next to John Turode, being around other people cooking, and some of the other contestants were exceptionally good cooks. I loved it, absolutely loved it. It was great. And dancing, if the thing about dancing was I thought I would be good at it. I thought there was a dancer in me waiting to be discovered, and actually there wasn't. And so the sort of gradual realisation that my discovery of my incompetence was going to be shared with 10 million people live on the television was just really, really challenging. I mean, I really enjoyed every minute of it, and I wasn't in the least bit scared. People say it must be terrifying to step out onto the stage when you don't know what you're doing. And actually, I enjoyed every moment of it. And I'm so lucky to have Di Buswell as my dance partner, who was fantastic. And I had such a good time. It was so much fun. Until you get canned. And actually, getting canned is horrible. Partly because I was canned in the second round and I was really enjoying myself and wanted to stay in longer. So it was like being sent home early from a party. And actually, partly it was discovering that I was really not very good at it at all. And that took a little bit of digesting, actually.
I think my biggest fear would be not the stepping out and performing, because I suppose, like you, we're sort of performers in our jobs, aren't we, as broadcasters and you as a musician. But my biggest fear would be stepping out and suddenly having an absolute mental block and not being able to remember any of the steps on live television.
Oh, I had that. I mean, I there were a couple of times when I thought, I have no idea what I'm meant to be doing now, but Di was extremely good at sort of almost kind of nudging me into the right position. And I did actually really enjoyed it. So the other thing that was fascinating about it was I'm always interested in how things work. And Strictly is something which is almost miraculous in the fact that every week a lot of highly talented people, I mean the people who make the programme, get together and produce a big chunk of live television with incredible complexity to it, and do it and make it look sort of effortless and brilliant. Professional dancers are just staggering. Athletes, artists, uncomplaining, extraordinary to see them at work. Dave and the band, just consummate professionals. The camera crews, there's this amazing woman called Fee who is the sort of coordinator, and she has to make sure week after week after week that are basically about 250 people are exactly in the right place at any given time. How she does that, I don't know, but she does. And so seeing how people who are really good at stuff, 14 makeup stations, seeing people get their hair done and their face done and their costumes, it was just wonderful to be sort of backstage.
And of course, these days, millions tune in to hear your measured and calming voice on Radio 4. What do you love about Saturday Live? Because it sounds to me as if you're sitting there just really loving every minute.
It's interesting to see that I've been doing it for a while now, so nearly 10 years, I think. And there's something that happens when you've been doing something for a long time, I think, where you just sort of realise that you have grown into it and it has grown into you and it works. And I've changed a lot in that time. I used to do it on my own, and then I got co-presenters, and that was, I'd never worked with a co-presenter before, and I really enjoyed that. Regime change every time there's a new editor, I really enjoyed that, learned an awful lot. It's a great team of people to work with. But I'm nosy, Helen, and it's just a great job for a nosy person, because I just get to talk to lots of people about stuff that's really interesting. And the other thing I really enjoy doing is sort of hosting people who you think are not likely to encounter each other. And then they do encounter each other. And all of a sudden, the conversation that they have can be surprising and illuminating. And to encourage that to happen, if you can encourage it to happen, is a really good thing. And I realise as I say this, that this is one of the reasons why I like being a vicar so much too, because a big part of that job is exactly the same thing. Only you don't have to crash the pips if you're vicaring.
The two sit very well hand in hand. I'm a bit nosy too. I suppose that's what a journalist is, really, fundamentally.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's been fantastic chatting to you today and hearing more about your life. I mean, we meet from time to time at various events, but we never get a chance to have a good old natter. And I hope doing this podcast today has given you almost as much pleasure as mowing your grass.
Oh, it really has. It's been lovely to talk to you. And really nice, as I say, our paths cross regularly, but we don't really have a chance to get to talk. So no, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, good. And what are you up to for the rest of the day?
I've very nearly finished the second book I have written in lockdown, diligent author that I am. So I'm on the last stretch of that. And it being the last stretch, I'm sort of at speed at the moment, and I'm really enjoying that. And then I've got a thing this afternoon. I know I've got a thing this afternoon, but for the moment I've forgotten what it is.
You slipped in there sort of rather subtly that you've been writing a book. I can't let you go without asking. Fact, fiction, what are you writing?
Two books, actually. I've written my first crime novel with The Vicar Detective. That's finished. And I have very nearly finished a second book, which is about grief, actually, because I started, as you say, I sort of tried to maintain social media stuff, even when I was writing about what it was like to lose David. And lots of people responded to that, because lots of people go through that. And so my publishers suggested that I start writing it up, and I have been writing it up. And and I'm pleased with it.
Thank you so much, Richard. You've been listening to the fantastic Reverend Richard Coles, and he's at Rev Richard Coles on Twitter and well worth a follow if you don't already. Do feel free to share our podcast with friends and family. We're at convex.podbean.com, or you can find us on Spotify and Apple and Google Podcasts. Just search The Convex Conversation. I'll be back with another fantastic guest next week, so bye for now.